Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Hype. This week, we're again missing Pete and Aaron, so it's again me doing the hosting. So apologies in advance for that, but we've got our man, Joseph Nation, here today with us. How are we doing, Joe?
Good. How are you?
Good as always. Pretty gassed to record Beyond the Hype, as always. And but this week, we do have a pretty special guest. We tried to get Caitlin Cooper, but she's a bit too good for us, so we had to settle for Plan B. But Mark Schindler of Indie Cornrows, who writes with, which is, you know, in conjunction with Caitlin Cooper, I guess. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm good. You know, normally I would be offended by that, but I'll just be completely honest. Caitlin is miles better than anybody in terms of
doing it. There's nobody covering a team better than Caitlin.
Yeah, Caitlin's incredible. But no, I'm psyched to be here, man. I'm always down to pod, and I love watching the Hornets, so I can't complain at all.
Okay, that's good, because we do have a fair few Hornets questions for you. So we'll do a quick recap of the Hornets last 2 weeks since we recorded. They've been miserable. Sorry, Jerry, what'd you say?
Miserable? Miserable is the word?
Yeah, that's probably fair to say.
We lost by 30 to Chicago?
I'm not going to lie, I did not actually watch that game. So, they've gone... They've won two games out of eight since we last recorded, so that's not the best. But they're hanging around in that.
It's not nearly as bad as it feels, though.
Yeah.
2-6 is, you know, it feels like we haven't won a game in months other than last night's.
The play hasn't been fantastic, but we're hanging around in that eighth seed, one spot ahead of Mark's own Indiana Pacers, which is good. I think one of the major stories of just the stretch, one of the silver linings, I guess, of the stretch without Hayward and Ball and Monk is Miles Bridges and his ongoing development. So, Mark, I wanted to ask you to start off. What are your opinions on Miles Bridges? And, you know, yeah, as I said in the agenda, keep these positive. Otherwise, this will be a very short podcast.
With Miles, I went to Michigan State around the same time that he was there, and it's really weird watching him now compared to then, because there were times where he was really good. I mean, you could tell athletically just miles ahead of it. He was so far ahead of everyone in terms of what he was athletically, but he really struggled with his handle, really struggled as a decision maker in the half court, and that has completely changed this year. He's not, you know, necessarily a game changer as a playmaker, but, you know, him playing a lot more at the four, the stuff he does in the short role is ridiculous. And his handle's just better. I talk with Richie Randall pretty regularly about this.
Like,
his handle and playmaking this year just blown me away, because even last year I was still asking, okay, well, is Miles ever going to be able to play the three? And now you can at least run lineups out there with him doing it. And I mean, the shot's been there too. With LaMelo has just been a joy to watch, and I can't wait for LaMelo to be back just so it happens again. And he's been better defensively too. He's still not great there, but I'm planning on doing a formal write-up, you know, in like a week or two. But I think if I had to vote today, I'd probably have him as most improved player. And I know it's taboo-ish to give it to second or third year players, but I mean, he's gone from being a complete negative last year to being a legitimately positive player on a good team now.
Okay, that's a very good take. You can tell that's a trained Hornets eye there, because that is the fact. I mean, the thing about, I guess, if you don't watch a team, it's easy to just look at a 6'6 athletic forward like Miles is, who shoots a decent volume of threes and shoots okay on them, and you can understand, you know, his numbers from three being a bit down on a bad team because not many good shots are created. You know, looking from outside, you can just assume like he's a good player just because he's athletic and he shoots threes. But it's just much more nuanced than that. Miles, I think we've talked about extensively on this podcast, you know, to the point where Joe had and probably still has for some reason, he prefers Jalen McDaniels to Miles now and long term. which is a take we will get him to defend again in very shortly. But Miles, you know, it's good to hear that that was constant at Michigan State. I didn't do a whole lot of draft research on Miles, so I was a little bit surprised in his sophomore year that it was honestly that bad, because this is a kid. I want to ask you about, like, did Miles flash passing, like the specific just passing at Michigan State? Because I thought last year, like, I know Richie's been saying he thinks Miles' passing has developed this year. And I don't think so, really, because I remember I clipped him a lot last season, and some of the passes he made last season with the live dribble, like, they were literally stuff only, like, guys like LeBron could make, because they were, you know, hanging in the air, hanging out of the sideline, and he'd pinpoint to the wing, that sort of thing. So I think the passing has always been there. And even last year, if you go through, like, his assists, he had a few amazing dimes in transition, you know, perfect waiting, you know, a bit like LaMelo Ball himself. So I think the passing's always been there. But, yeah, it's been good that he's been putting more short roles, and then he's now started to get the handling going. So he's been able to utilize it a bit more. So, yeah, back to that passing question. How did Miles' passing rate at Michigan State?
Well, I would say, I mean, he's always had the capability of passing, but it's just the handle together has allowed him to be actually do it now. I mean, you know, without being able to be in those live dribble situations, you didn't see the flashes as often just because he wasn't able to do it. And so, I mean, I guess he's always had, like, I mean, playmaking is not something that you normally just develop. It's hard to develop, as, you know, talking to PD or anybody. But I would agree, like, the passing has been there, but just having the capability to do it now is why it's showing through so much.
Right. Yeah. And I think that there's an important way that you phrased it in there, in that basically what's changed here is just the opportunity that he has to actually show it. So, like, you know, back at Michigan State, talking about the way that it was pre-draft, he was one of the many players inflicted with the, oh yeah, he's Draymond again, even though it was obviously very, very wrong. He's not actually really much like Draymond, but the reason for that was because of the, like, extreme passing skill for a forward. So it's certainly not coming out of nowhere, but what has changed is the level of opportunity that he's getting, of getting into space and getting those advantage situations to make the reads that he does.
Yeah, definitely. I would totally agree with that. And it's so annoying too, because I don't know if you remember this. You remember when people said Brandon Dawson was going to be the next Draymond coming out?
Yes.
Oh my God, that did not happen.
The entire draft community has declared at this point a complete moratorium on any Draymond Green comparisons, except
never
that
never call anybody a top tier like Draymond. It's just a bad idea.
So Scotty
Barnes, Jalen Johnson, no Draymond tags, Joe.
But it's fundamentally different, right? So Scotty is a legitimately great defensive prospect. He's still not Draymond. He's actually outpassing Draymond statistically on the year from the forward position. He's at 31.5% assist percent. I believe his maximum year was somewhere in the 20s, but I could also be getting messed up by a height filter in there somewhere along the way. But the way that they handle is fundamentally different, because basically Scotty, by and large, is using his length to ward guys off, combined with his height, because the length is actually pretty comparable, and is running more like a true point guard, where Draymond kind of, like, in college especially, his play was much more – I mean, he was an Izzo big. You know, some of them get to make perimeter plays, but most of them, like, inherently with every college system, you're going to post up a lot more, and – Barnes being played at the point guard made it to where the pre-draft tape looked very different.
All right. Makes sense.
Draymond,
yeah, he's absolutely an outlier. I mean, like, I've been pretty critical of his play this year, because I think basically he's gotten off, because every second game he takes off, but somehow, you know, the national media games are the one that he doesn't take off. So people do see him, but, like, a vintage Draymond performance is still, like, it's still something else. Like, he's legitimately walling up guys, you know, bodying up guys like Vucevic and Valanciunas in the post, and, you know, only conceding jump hooks to them. And, like, that's just, like, to be, yeah, you know, to do that while still being able to run the pace, run the break with legitimate pace, and, you know, switch onto guards is something else, man. So, that seems a good decision by Draft Twitter. I just wanted to say one more thing on Miles. So, hypothetical. So, you know, it's end of this season. entering his fourth season, you've got to make a decision on what extension to offer Miles Bridges. Basically, how far do you go with that? Because at this stage, like, his box score numbers this year aren't amazing. I think I'm pretty sure he's averaging like 11.7 points, six rebounds. The specific shooting splits look very good. But for the Hornets' sake, hopefully Melo coming back soon can reduce Miles' usage down a little bit. I mean, and it's not that it's the unassisted stuff, it's getting Miles Bridges' stats inflated, but it's just in general. Since the injuries have happened, he's just handled the ball a little bit more, and he's shown he can handle a bit higher usage, but that probably will go with ball back to an extent. But yeah, like right now, I'm very concerned about him, you know, not being signed, entering year four, and then balling out year four basically. And because he's an athletic forward who can shoot threes, but then he's actually good and he can handle the ball a little bit, I could see him getting just some really high offers. So guess Joe, start with you for this one.
Yeah, so I mean, the market there is more or less set by the extensions for Anunoby and Isaac, and I think that Bridges is just clearly worse than those two.
Yeah,
but both of them got underpaid, and they were being paid by teams who are aiming largely to conserve future cap space, whereas the Hornets have no such concern. Basically, they're over the cap for the foreseeable future. They'll be over the cap in 2022 and likely in 2023, barring some bad decisions. The result of that is that they really don't need to worry too much about preserving that future cap space. They might descend the contract instead, but if we're going in the range of, like, let's say 4 years, $60 million with incentives that total to bring it to as high as 4 years, $72 million, that's about consistent with the market. It starts a little bit below, but the incentives can bring it above where Anunoby and Isaac are. It's, you know, generally probably fair value for his actual production. And it also safeguards you against what I view as his biggest problem, in that, well, he's not necessarily able to scale up as easily, in the sense that basically his production right now was very good, but it took all these guys getting injured. And when those guys weren't injured, we were struggling massively to get him appropriate usage. And so basically, if you can't give him those on-ball touches, which he's excelling in, let's be fair here, he's a bit harder to work with. And that's kind of the worry going forward, is that, well, basically, if he doesn't maintain the current level of play, then that extension becomes not worth it, even if he has been largely good over the course of the season.
Okay, just before Mark Johnson, I'm going to say, like, yeah, like, that's another thing. It'll be very interesting to see how Borrego balances Miles' touches when Melo comes back, because I think he leads the team in touches and, you know, dribbles and all those sort of stats this season. And yeah, because I think Miles has been ready for on-ball touches since the start of the season. I think I've been, like, vocal about that. And because the thing is, even with his recent ball handling development, you can see there's so many, like, minor issues he needs to work on. Like, he can't even do a rip-through move properly, the one that LaMelo picked up in 2 weeks. So, you know, there's stuff he needs to work on, the stuff he needs to pick up. But I think everyone remembers, like, in his sophomore season, he was really struggling to even just do the basic, you know, shoulder bump initiate contact move. And he's getting better at that now. So you can see just, I think he's showing he's picking up stuff. You know, it's not at the pace of, you know, certain, you know, developmental freaks. And in general, yeah, like, the handling, I think, is just good enough to where it justifies usage anyway. And I don't think the Hornets offense is like, I feel like the Hornets offense is a classic example of just, like, process versus results, because a lot of, like, the offense is good. Like, Borrego and the offense is good. And we'll get into some Nate Bjorken versus Borrego comparisons on offense a bit later, but the offense is good. But I don't think it's, like, infallible by any means to where Miles Bridges should not be getting on-ball touches, especially if you're seeing now, like, whenever the Hornets run a 4-5 pick and roll, teams are really struggling to, you know, get that forward to initially just go over the screen and contest the Miles pull-off three, because they're not expecting it. And Miles is getting, you know, practice shots out of those shots and he's catching them. And then, you know, then you got, you know, with Borrego's ability, it's just he knows every set in basketball. And he's already, like, even last year, I'm sure he's run some good stuff to get Miles, you know, downhill, off the dribble sort of action. And the fact that he's passing that up, and yet, like, Rozier and Hayward, they get so many ISO opportunities, you know, and they're doing well in ISO opportunities. Everyone knows I'm not the biggest Rozier fan. To see him hit those, you know, leaning 15-foot, you know, mid-range leaning jumpers consistently is frustrating a little bit. But, you know, that's to his credit. But it does feel like, you know, every opportunity that does break down into an ISO is, it just feels like a bit of a missed opportunity. Give Miles some touches. So, yeah, Mark, how are you feeling about a Miles extension and what it looked like?
Yeah, lots to unpack there. I think the biggest thing I would say with the extension, I agree with Joseph. Like, coming into this year, I wasn't even sure of going over, like, you know, maybe a like a 3 for 45 felt generous, just seeing what we've seen so far. But, you know, obviously with how things have escalated, and I try not to look too much at this recent stretch, because like you're mentioning, I don't know, I'm sure, I hope front offices look at it like this too. Like, okay, well, Gordon Hayward was out, LaMelo was out, PJ missed a bunch of time. Like, it's not just like he's doing this in a great context. Like, it's he's kind of getting forced into it. It's not like he's been bad. He's been good at it, but just given the acceleration already this year, I don't really think that this is something I buy that's sustainable. You know, maybe in time he's able to do something like this, but I mean, like you were saying about how quickly LaMelo has picked up stuff. I mean, clearly that just hasn't happened with Miles, and that's guys develop at different rates. And I think I would be hesitant to go over like a 4 for 72 or something like that, just because, you know, teams do get pretty willing to throw the bag at athletic wings. So I'll be interested to see how that plays out. But at the same time, I mean, if you're Charlotte, I mean, I wouldn't want to pass up on him. I wouldn't want to, like, I think I would rather sign Miles and maybe trade him than not sign him, just because, I mean, like you see with Boston and not signing Hayward, like there's a lot to it, but it's better to have the contract than not have the contract in a lot of regards. But yeah, I mean, I'm high on Miles too, so that makes it different. But in terms of looking at what he's doing right now and getting more touches and pick and roll or in isolation opportunities, it's really tough. And it's something I try and grapple with a lot too, looking at the Pacers. Like, they're definitely a more veteran team, but they've been in a similar situation in some regards. Like, there are a lot of times, especially last year too, where, you know, I want to see Edmund Sumner play. I want to see it, like, this year. I want Edmund Sumner to get higher leverage opportunity stuff down the shot clock. But at the same time, I think it's more of an organizational thing than coaching. You know, as much as they're going to talk about how they're a young team and this and that, I mean, you know, like the mandate for Michael Jordan and the Charlotte Hornets is to make the playoffs. They're not taking any time off. That's how the Pacers are as well, probably even more so ratcheted up. So as much as I'd love to see Miles get those touches and it would be great developmental wise, I mean, there's a reason why it's Terry and Gordon Hayward taking them. So it's hard to put it on the coach. It's just organizations being organizations, and it's annoying sometimes, but that's just kind of how it is when you're stuck in between the way that your team is set up. So I guess that's the only real answer I have on it. It has been wild to watch Terry Rozier take those, like, one dribble off the bounce 17 footers and have them fall in, because I'm so used to watching him in Boston and that shit just hitting the side of the rim.
I think it's fair to say that he's, like, he's a contender for the best in the league of that shot at this point, because
he's been fantastic at
that. Like, I don't even know how to describe it. Like, they're always well defended, and they, like,
everything hit about watching them hurts.
Yeah, because, like, they hit, it's not like a consistent, like, part of the iron that it hits either. Like, he'll hit back, or he'll hit the backboard first, or he'll hit not so much backboard first, but he'll hit the front, he'll hit the side, he'll hit the back, and it'll always drop in somehow. So, but credit to Terry. I think you guys brought up a really good point in that, you know, like, how sustainable it is, and extending off that, like, how much can the Hornets realistically afford to factor Miles in to the offense moving forward? Because if Hayward stays this offseason, if, God forbid, Rozier stays and we continue, and Monk stay, both of them, and we continue to have this crazy overload at the guard position while neglecting the wing positions, then there's really just not touches to go around for Miles. And then that would be a shame, because I think the way he's playing now too, like, if a drive gets cut off, he's by default going to, like, a DHO rather than just continuing the drive. And I think that's something that just really bodes well for giving a guy touches, because it means as long as you get into the offense properly with some pace, which regular teams have struggled to do in the past and probably been a bit better this year. But, you know, if you give it to him 20 seconds on the shot clock, he makes a move, it gets cut off, go to DHO with 12 seconds or 10 seconds, that can still turn into a very good offensive possession, especially with how well coached the Hornets are, with how well plays 1 through 5 this year, moving off the ball, you know, getting to the proper spacing position. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I'm personally pro moving Rozier and Haywood and possibly even Devontae this offseason to get Miles those touches because, one, I think this core is not enough. That's probably the main thing, and we need a bit more juice. So bringing in a bit more younger talent, resetting, rebalancing the roster a bit over the next few years is a good thing in the long term. But also, I think Miles is ready for it. It's just, like, right now, he's not going to be, like, putting guys in jail and, like, you know, running pick and roll at that tempo. But if you're talking about the tools, the handlings, I think it's gotten to a point where the pick and roll will be effective to an extent, and that extent hasn't been reached. I think the passing is something that will translate very well to pick and roll down the road. So we probably do need to get into some Pacers talk.
So one quick question though. Yeah. So in terms of looking and moving forward, because I mean I hear you say trading Gordon Hayward, I'm like, shit. Like and I understand because I talk with you fairly regularly, so I understand where you're coming from, but just like what is your definition of the young core being enough? Like, what do you view as being enough, or what, like, you know, where, what is ultimate goal then?
Okay. Like the thing is, I honestly don't seriously view the Hornets as a threat moving forward, just because the way the roster is constructed, it's like the best perimeter defender that you can see being a member of the rotation moving forward is PJ Washington, who seems like he'll play a lot of five. It's actually funny how they have Devontae, they've run units with Devontae, Terry, LaMelo, Haywood as a 1 through 4. And like, to be honest, I'm not exactly sure how that's not managed to be a, you know, record bad defense in the league, because, you know, you just look at the names there, you know, Terry, you know, on paper should be a good perimeter defender. He's quick. He's pretty strong for his size, but he gets blown by bench guards consistently. You got Devontae, who's just not actually that quick. So even though I think his, you know, technique on screen navigation and his off ball is a little bit better than Terry, he's just not a good defender at all. He's not close to actually being good off ball or actually having good screen adaptation technique to the point where it overrides lack of size. And then you got Haywood, who, you know, offensive load this year plays a big part. So I think you can understand him taking a few plays off on D here and there. But his on ball D is, you know, it's not been good for a few years now. He's clearly added a lot of mass to his body, I think, to prevent injuries. And most of his injuries recently have been, you know, like freak accidents. They've not been related to like that sort of thing. They've just been, you know, freak accidents, someone landing on him or breaking a finger, that sort of thing, stuff you can't really prevent. But, you know, his perimeter defense is well down. I think he's a power forward at this stage. And then LaMelo, like, you know, I think he's been getting better. I think there's a bit of a divide between where I view Melo's perimeter defense in comparison to most of the people. I still think it's
looked a lot better because they're playing mostly zone. If they were playing a lot more, like, man-to-man, it wouldn't look as good for
sure. Okay, that's another thing. Like, Rager's done really well with schemes because his whole roster is trained really well to help aggressively from the wings, I guess, at the nail on drives, even in isolation, which is typically quite hard to coordinate. It does mean when you have the whole roster doing it, you have some, you know, not so good defenders like Rozier, Martin Twins, Biombo, just doing it when you really can't afford to be doing it and you should be communicating to your weak side guy. You rotate instead because I'm on Joe Harris or I'm on, you know, Damian Lillard. I should not be helping you, but they do it anyway because, you know, but basically I think it's a good thing overall, but it has meant that I don't think our guys have been exposed one-on-one as they would have been last year, for example, because there were games where we'd switched Bismack Biyombo onto a genuinely good ball handler and a straight blow by and dunk wouldn't happen because the gap help would be there. So, but that's kind of unrelated. So we do need to get to some talk on the Pacers and the Hornets. Anyway, Pacers Hornets play-in. That's why I got a mark on here. How would you two feel about a Pacers Hornets play-in matchup? Because it's looking like that's a genuine possibility. The Hornets are slipping a bit. Actually, I guess before we're going to get into that, so we're going to ask Mark if how are the Pacers just tracking at the moment?
They are going like as far down as they can right now. I mean, Miles Turner is probably going to be out for the year, which sucks. Just because he was having a great year. I had him second in defensive player of the year, and now he's probably not even going to make the all-defense team because Clint Capella has been awesome. So I won't be surprised if he takes over for him on the second team. You know, without Miles, their defense is abhorrent. It's good when he's on the court, but even when he's on the roster, like, the defense is not great when he's off the court. And a lot of it's scheme. I don't think it's all on the roster. A lot of it is just like the scheme mixed with the roster is like with a lot of questions with that. But no, I mean, Domas is out right now. Goga is out. So they're playing. They just cut Brian Bowen yesterday and gave Amit Abrima a two-way so that they have some kind of immediate stopgap to play the five. It has been like a whole slew of injuries the entire year, starting with, I mean, they were healthy to start the year until TJ went out and then went out for the year. You know, you have the Victor trade happens and you find out that Karis has cancer, and luckily he's okay now and everything worked out all right. But you go through an entire 20 game stretch without Karis, and that led to the initial downturn of the year. So it's just been a very a murky season. That's been really hard to evaluate. And the Pacers are not really in a great spot right now. And I think barring some tremendous play from younger guys who I don't think are going to be able to play quite at the level that they need to, I don't think that they're going to go up. And I actually do. I think there's a chance that they might fall out of the play-in entirely.
Yeah. I didn't know Turner was out for the year. So that,
well, it's not. Okay. So that's just more speculation. He's listed as indefinite, but indefinite is like, that's the death sentence for if you're going to come back. So
I know it was a foot injury. What exactly was the injury?
It was phrased very oddly. A plantar plate in his great toe, which is his big toe, but they called it great toe on the initial injury report for whatever reason. But just given, like, I mean, it's basically plantar fasciitis, but in your toe. And that's what's kept TJ Warren out for the entire year. That's the kind of thing where even if it like gets to a point where it's feeling better, until it's all the way healed, it's, I mean, chance of flaring up. So
right, yeah, it's a pain management kind of injury, which never fun. But honestly, like, definitely I can't imagine that the Pacers are in a position to kind of like push to bring him back right now. Is the other thing where it's like, you know, is it really worth pushing to bring him back for the 10th seed?
Yes, that's they might think a lot differently than I do on that one. I would lean no, don't bring him back, just let him rest up. But they we'll see what happens with that. Not that, like, they don't push guys to play injured or anything, but I mean, just their mandate is they always want to play balls to the wall and win as many games as possible. And this is just, I mean, I think this is the right year to you know, do what Detroit did and trade for Corey Joseph to be your starting point guard. That's
or, you know, to re-sign Bismack Biyombo.
I'll never forget, man, the first 3 weeks of the year, I was like, oh my God, Biz is catching some passes now. And it just, it hasn't mattered. It's like, it's a sad story, man.
The thing is, last year when we were like full on, just like everyone knew we were bad, it was actually fun to get around Biz because he would have those stretches, you know, where he'd catch passes. And then all of a sudden on offense, he becomes perhaps even an above average standard given, you know, he's actually able to pass these days, which is amazing considering where he's come from. But, you know, yeah, once you are actually, your chance of being an actual good team, it gets a bit jarring to see that man, you know, be the worst defender on the court at times. So,
so in terms of how the matchup has played out this season, right, Hornets won the matchup 2-1. Pacers were actually surprisingly healthy for both matchups in the sense that, like, Brogdon, who I think of as having missed a fair bit of time this year, played both games. I believe Sabonis and Turner played both of them, all three games, except one of them missed the last game.
That sounds about right.
So in general, like, reasonably even games. The first one was a blowout because Doug McDermott went off for whatever reason, and did so without even shooting well from three. I think he was something like combined 11 for 17 from two. And part of that was because of, you know, our
go-to guy for lock and trail when he runs into a 6'10" 9" powerful cutter sort of guy.
Yeah,
you know, a team running five out, it's not going to turn out well. So,
yep. Well, in that specific game, I believe that specific game was similar to the Golden State first quarter as well, where basically it was just like, basically LaMelo and Rozier getting back cut continually. And that's probably still going to be an issue next time around. So, but the good thing is we came back 2 days later and we're fine. So here we are. In general, the biggest strategic adjustment that worries me is the non-zero possibility of Borrego thinking it's a good idea to run out, Bismack and Cody together again. Because that happened last year and was a real thing that I did not hallucinate. And it's still very hard to believe. just because those two, like, you know, should have never shared the court together. Bismack shouldn't have been on the court in general, but it happened. So have to consider that as a realistic possibility, though I think no Turner probably decreases the odds of it. One game sample also means, you know, way fewer chances of like crazy way out there adjustments, I suppose. Yeah, that, I mean, as matchups go, it's about as blah as a matchup as you can get. There's no like interesting key. Oh yeah, this guy is just really well set up to kill this guy. And, you know, in general, I suspect that McConnell will have a good series in the sense that like he will have relatively simplistic guards to attack in terms of like his defense versus their offense. You know, past that, like, eh.
Before Mark jumps in. Yeah, I'm going to get into a bit of the Bjorken versus Rego comparison here in one aspect. So I listened to Caitlin Cooper's podcast with Bouncing Around, who are, in my opinion, the best basketball podcast going around at the moment. But that said, I have not actually started listening to the Dunker Spot, so probably should do that. But Bouncing Around, they're awesome. Big endorsement for me, whatever that means. Yeah, so, and then she got to Bjorken, how it seems like his principles have been somewhat, like, he's not a rigid coach, but he's somewhat stuck to his overall principles throughout the season, especially on defense. So me and Joe, we're pretty, I don't think, like, even Filippo said that Borrego can't adjust. So if a Borrego stan is saying Borrego can't adjust, he can't adjust. He's one of the worst adjustment coaches in the league because, as Joe was saying, his defense, he thinks Bismack Biyombo and Cody Manu's two best defenders. So his solutions always involve just subbing one of those guys in. And, you know, what usually happens is the actual momentum gets broken up because it takes time out to sub those two in. So, but if it's an actual all-star, like, that won't matter, right? So if a team with an all-star will just continue to blitz us. So in the regular season, though, you would say, the playoffs are different. Playoffs are a different animal. So we haven't even seen Borrego in a playoff series, and we've seen some matchups specifically where Borrego can actually come up with good game plans. I think Milwaukee, notably, he's basically nailed that one since he's come in. His first game as Hornets coach was a season opener, 2018-19, where Kemba went for 40, and we got MKG at the five, and it worked so well. And I think that's just generally been the formula for Borrego since then. He's gone super small. MKG worked really well at the five, or Marvin, which did not work as well because Marvin's washed for a while now, to be honest. And then PJ at the five, which has been, you know, been awesome. How do you feel, Mark? Yeah. So yeah, how do you think Bjorken's going to do in the playoffs?
Yeah. It's kind of funny because we went from Nate McMillan last year being very, I don't want to say stuck in his ways, but in some regards, yes. Like, he was not great at adjusting some stuff early. Like, I think he was willing to make adjustments in game, but he wouldn't come out with automatic adjustments to start the series, which is things that were frustrating. Like, it's stuff like you can see coming out, like, okay, like, we know Duncan Robinson is a really good shooter. Maybe we should switch on those actions when he's coming around screens, or instead of forcing Justin Holiday to run through, you know, a house of 1,000 screens, just do something easier, because that was something that really frustrated the players. So I think when I look at that, like, Nate Bjorken's been great at, like, coming out with some adjustments like that. But I also think, like, Caitlin's way of putting it is they kind of throw the kitchen sink on defense, and it's not always good. And a lot of times it's – I think it's, like, 80-20 or, like, 85-15 for me. Like, 80% of the stuff I love, I'm like, this is great. You know, you're trying new things. I get trying to be multiple on defense, but at the same time, you go from having – a team that was sixth in defense last year with largely the same guys to now being almost like right below league average or right around league average because you're changing the scheme up so much. So I personally think they could tone it back a little bit. Like, instead of, you know, coming out in box and one, like, there was a play against Atlanta where they came out in box and one and left the corner man wide open, like 10 feet off him, like coming out exactly in a box and one on an inbounds play. And believe it or not, the corner man took a wide open corner shot after two swing passes. And I'm like, no fucking shit. I'm sorry. I don't even know if I'm allowed to swear on this, but, like, no shit. He shoots the ball and it drops him. Like, it's things like that. There are, like, there's just enough possessions that happen where you're like, well, why? Well, just make it simpler. And guys have talked about, without saying it, they've said, you know, that they can sometimes get confused with the amount of things that they're trying to run. And they're like, yeah, I'm not really sure what we were doing out there. It's like, we have so many coverages. I'm not entirely, you know, it's hard to remember all of it. And that's not exact wording, but in those lines, like, and there are times where it looks like guys are running two different coverages because they're either mixed up in it or something like that. And it's been a little bit better recently. Not with Miles out, but there was a stretch when Miles was there and Karis was back that it looked good. But overall, it's just, especially too, like the zone defense is so bad. Their zone defense is horrible. Yes, every time they come out on in zone, it's just like, why, you know? And it's gotten a little bit better recently, but it's just, it's all like the angling. Like they'll have their back to the ball or have their back to their man. It's just like, instead of doing things to split the difference, like little things that you would get taught in like high school or rec league, like and this is not to like just totally crap on them, but it's just, I don't know. It's just like the little things. If you could just cut out some stuff, I think it would be a lot better. Again, it's still really hard to evaluate with all the guys out on the roster, but the offense I've been impressed with. I do like the offense. I think before Victor was traded, they were, I want to say, top 10 in both. So that was 12 games in. So it's a small sample size, but I thought that was a lot more indicative of what he was putting out on the court. And the offense has just been better overall. Like, there's replacement actions happen on the weak side, and, you know, they do things that just make sense. Like, there's cutting built into the offense. And that's not what it used to be like. It used to be very, I just would call it the drive and die offense, because there'd be one drive and then it gets into an isolation if there's not an action that happens right away. So I've been pretty impressed with that. I think it's been a lot of stuff on the offensive end that I like. The ATOs are better. The out of bounds plays are better. But the defense, I definitely have questions about. But I do think in a playoff series, Charlotte's actually a really tough matchup for the Pacers, in my opinion, especially without TJ Warren. Like, I think if you have TJ, I would pretty comfortably pick Indiana to win, a seven game series. But if it's a seven game series right now, I would maybe lean towards Charlotte just because of the versatility that they have. And if you're able to come out and win the first game, that makes a big difference too, you know? It sounds trivial, but like, just winning the first game in a series matters a ton. And I think there's enough that Charlotte could do to confuse the Pacers, but also just they have an abundance of guys who are 6'6 to 6'10 that are forwards that can handle the ball. And those are the kind of guys that can really punish the Pacers.
Right. Okay. That's interesting because, I mean, we're talking about Miles and whether his ball handling is still going to be a factor in the offense post. But yeah, Gordon Hayward's a problem. I mean, That's the one thing. I mean, he's probably a genuine like top 40 player, because he's probably being conservative this year, especially in his like better stretches. Because man, he's so powerful. Like, I did not expect him to do it this way, just overpowering guys. And then when combined with his skill, I mean, I've been a big fan of Harrison Barnes this season. Whenever he does get the chance to drive, because the guy with that power, that much finesse, that footwork. I mean, but how he's basically been that, but he's good enough in the pick and roll to get his own touches without a coach needing to drop a play for him. So yeah, Hayward's a problem. That's fair. I think defending the Hornets is going to be a challenge, because the preparation does need to be top notch. I do think you can kind of get away with cutting corners on certain actions. Like, for example, like Rozier's running a lot of pick and rolls, and teams don't quite catch on until maybe the last 2 minutes that you can just blitz him and he's never going to hit the roll man. So you can kind of take liberties there. As long as, you know, there's kind of like a fake weak side tag on the roll man for when Terry hits Devontae, so they can't immediately hit them for a wide open pass. But yeah, so like there's a few schematic things that seem like just low hanging fruit that teams haven't really caught on to yet. Like LaMelo, I think you should 100% go under, you know, make him hit shots first before you start doing other stuff. If Melo is hitting shots, I think that combined with Hayward, it's probably that's just at a point where the Hornets, the Pacers have to outgun the Hornets. I think there's a chance the Pacers could outgun the Hornets. I don't think we're a good defense at all. I don't think Gregor is good at defensive schemes at all. And I think, I mean, Joe said there's not like an obvious weak point for the Pacers to exploit. I think Doug McDermott, like, if he can get on the court for defense, he should kill us. Like, I don't think there's any doubt about that. Because the way he killed us in those games, it was not really it's sustainable stuff. It's just cuts and stuff. He's, and a lot of them, he was using his power straight up. like, you know, even if Rozier, Melo got it bang on most of the time with those actions, you know, he's just powerful. So he can get into the body, you know, explode off a little bit. And that's probably going to work a decent amount. So, but yeah, yeah, no Turner definitely probably leads it to the Hornets. No Turner and Warren. Yeah, I guess it's pretty interesting to revisit the Gordon Hayward, Miles Turner, sign trade, whatever that was in the offseason. I'm not gonna lie, that was a low point for me as a fierce anti-Celtics man, because, you know, yeah, the Pacers, like, I'm not a super high Miles guy, but the fact is, like, and at that point, I think Kemba for Drew Holiday was also rumored as well. So you could just imagine, you know, like, far out, Drew, Smart, JB, Tatum, Miles. Like, what a nightmare that would be to deal with on defense. But, and yeah, so they, and then Boston, it just felt like, you know, Danny Ainge, I don't think he's an elite GM at all. I think his resume is propped up a lot by one single trade. And then otherwise, he's generally, I think it's fair to say he's good, but he's nothing special. And I thought that he was going to get away with one again. You know, he backed himself into a corner and he'd get his way out of it. But very happy it turned out with Boston ending up with nothing except a trade exception, which they used on Fournier, which is, I think he's a good player. I think given, you know, his expiring contract, his fit with the roster, they would be hoping they did a lot more with it. I mean, we stretched Batum. Obviously, I think the long-term implications of it are yet to really be shown. And I think it's still fair to question if it was the right move overall. Of course, if we make the playoffs this year for one, I think that's a huge, you know, notch in its favor. Mark, how do you feel about the Hayward Turner thing in the end? And yeah, do you, I mean, kind of prefer that you got Hayward instead of Turner or not?
And also, to what extent do you believe it was actually on the table? Just because that's kind of been up in the air.
Good question. Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on that. I think number one, I loved that Charlotte got Hayward. I got really frustrated with, because I'm not trying to make it sound like I'm a CBA genius or anything, but I mean, I like to think I have a pretty good working knowledge of the CBA and understanding, you know, cap structure and stuff like that. I was pretty frustrated with the blowback from people looking at the Hornets talking about how they massively overpaid Hayward. I'm like, okay, number one, how the hell else are they getting Gordon Hayward? Number two, he's an elite player. That's what matters.
What are you talking about? We've got a history of getting good free agents. You know.
yeah. I forgot about that. Michael that Jordan's happens. There. Yeah. I mean, come on. Yeah. And I just think, like, that you can't run your team like the Lakers if you're not the Lakers. Like, I wish that people would understand that sometimes. Efficiency is important, but you have to find ways to make adjustments and find other ways as a smaller team. And I think if you have an opportunity to get somebody like Gordon Hayward, that back end of that contract might not look great, but regardless, I'd rather have the contract and the player and be able to move on from it than just sit it out and, you know, sit on your hands and do nothing. So I love that trade for Charlotte. I like obviously it's weird with the state. Like, I mean, I liked Charlotte last year. They were one of my favorite league pass teams. PJ was awesome to watch in his rookie year. He's still fun to watch, but of course, I mean, like, awesome. Last year was just a surprise. So it makes things a little bit weird because you go from, like, thinking, okay, maybe this team isn't a full rebuild to now, okay, well, they were rebuilding for like a year and now they're going for it. And I mean, I should have expected that with Charlotte. I don't mean that in a bad way. Like, I think this team has a trajectory to be like a solid team, like maybe a second round playoff team somewhere around there. And you never know how things could break from there. So I liked that. I liked that aspect. I think it's good to do that. And just to be competitive and find ways to win. Because for the most part, talking about getting a championship is really overrated to me, because, you know, there's a lot fucking more that happens than getting a championship. Like, one of my favorite teams of all time is the 97-98 Charlotte Hornets, and they lost in the first round. So, like, because that's, I mean, Glenn Rice has his record setting here. I think he shot 47.7% from three on like eight attempts a game. The line was still shortened. I don't give a shit. Glenn Rice was awesome. There's just a fun, weird hodgepodge team, but point being, I think it's a good thing in terms of for the Pacers. I think, and it's something I come back on a lot, because I'm at the point where I think if they don't move one of the bigs this offseason, it would be a mistake. I just think that I've seen enough this year and last year that I don't think unless some kind of major thing breaks through on the rest of the roster. I just don't know if it's going to be good enough to get to I mean, I think their goal is to make second round of the playoffs and farther for the next couple of years. And I don't know if they're doing that with both bigs on the roster. I think it's just really hard to make that work, especially too with Goga developing. And I think he's already proven to be a good enough player to be a rotation player every day.
Oh, that first Pacers one of the matches, he blocked everything.
He's got a lot to learn as a defender, but like the fact, I mean, he's barely played 100 NBA games.
He's
getting to where he's at already. And I mean, he started hitting the three and taking the three more. It's been good. But I would say I never really know what direction to go in terms of which guy I would trade. I think what I ultimately say is whoever would get you the most value is who I would trade, because that's what you want. You want to get the best player back that you can. It's hard to envision trading a big for a wing player. Obviously it's doable, but it's just given how things work out, that's not normally what happens. It's tough because I think you see Miles, and it's like, if you have Miles on the team, like I think people don't understand how good he is defensively. And he really put things together offensively this year too. And it just improved his feel for the game overall. So I think if you have him on the team, you can at least see in terms of fit, like, okay, if you have him and there's a guy who's actually a four playing the four, and you're playing some more conventional defense that makes sense for your roster. I mean, that's like a top five defense. They were top three. I mean, they were third 2 years ago. They were sixth last year. So you can see that. But then it's also like, okay, well, Domas is just a good player. Like, he's a damn good player. And the best way that I've ever had it summed up to me is talking to a G League coach. They were like, you know, at some point, at the end of the day, having good basketball players is what's important, and you figure out from there. So then at another point, I'm like, okay, well, this is on the coaching staff. You know, whether it's Miles or Domas, like, I think you look at it and it's like, okay, well, Domas is like, on balance, I personally think Malcolm is the best player on the team. I think he's a little bit more important to what the team does than – like,
no pushback here for reference.
Yeah, I go back.
Oh, yeah. Well, just before we get into that, Joe's got Brogdon ahead of Westbrook, so he's very.
I would have Brogdon ahead of Westbrook right now.
Oh, whoa. Okay, that's okay.
Russ has it's just Russ from 2 years ago. No, but Russ now, yeah, Brogdon.
No. Okay. Well, I'm just wondering where was this
2 years ago as well.
No. So where was this when I was saying Russell Westbrook's not a top 35 player in offseason? Where was my support, Mark? That's my question for you.
Well, because Russell Westbrook was a top 35 player last year.
So Brogdon now was top 25.
No, he was not top 25. I wouldn't have him there. He had an okay year last year, but he kind of he was good in his role, but you could tell he was feeling out being a high ball usage player. And the efficiency was rough for him last year. His three ball was down. It's been better this year. He's been like an elite two guard. But it's tough. I like Russ as a talent, definitely a better player. But in terms of like in their role, I think Malcolm's probably better this year.
I don't know. People have been calling for people were saying the Domas Miles thing would never work. I guess finally on that, like, yeah, so you think overall it didn't work, or you think more so?
I think it's tough because, like, it can work, but I think it's more like I look at it, you know, they really struggle against the top eight teams in the league. They're good when they play against, regular competition, they can make it work, and it's fantastic. But I think I look at a lot of times, like, looking at playing Boston, and Boston's able to run four out, and it's different this year because they were running that awful-ass conglomeration of Tristan Thompson and Daniel Tice as a starting lineup, and it was just terrible. But I think you look at, all right, well, when Boston had last year and they were running Hayward at the four, like, that was killer. They struggled so much on the long closeouts, just dealing with the ball movement and handling that defensively, and I don't think that they weren't able to do enough offensively to counterbalance it. And I just think that's going to be the problem for most of the teams that they're going to face. I think with Philadelphia, Miles has actually played okay against Joel Embiid this year compared to how he has in previous years. But again, like, it's always been unfair to say Miles should be able to guard him one-on-one. Nobody can guard him one-on-one. So get out of my mentions. but just looking at the Heat, like, playing against the Heat's really difficult. Even now, like, Having to close out on Trevor Ariza, who's shooting well from three on high volume, like they can't, you know, it's asking a lot out of Sabonis or Turner to close out to the corner and not be in a better position for them. Like the context isn't great for them defensively. So I just think it can actually make more sense offensively than it does defensively. And it's just not like, I think if you put out a wing player who is, you know, 90% of the value, but can handle the ball and can like, say you swap, Domas or Miles, let's say Miles with Harrison Barnes, like Harrison Barnes at the four, really good. And I think it makes just more sense for the team overall if you have that kind of player out there instead of a second big. So I would say it's not like it's a failure, but I've seen enough to say it's time to go in a new direction.
At least from my perspective, losing TJ Warren, who for this entire year, who in my view was supposed to be that guy who takes the minutes at the four when they need a more wingy guy out there, probably was a bigger deal than at least I perceived it would be.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I totally agree, man. I think in some ways it was good because it's showing the flaws of the roster even more. Cause TJ was the only four on the roster. Like the only guy who can credibly play defense on a four. Like, I mean, Justin Holiday does it, but he's 185 pounds soaking wet. Jakarr Sampson just can't do enough offensively to stay out there. Yeah. Like he really is a five at this point and it sucks for him. Like I really was hoping that he would develop some kind of touch and it just hasn't happened, but O'Shea Brissett is at least, I mean, that's been nice. Like they just signed him to a multi-year deal and he looks very capable of doing that. But again, like he's a guy who you should be like your ninth or 10th man. So it's, I think a lot of it is going to be, like you mentioned, like not having TJ has shown a lot of that. And also offensively too, like they went from being, like they've never been great in the fourth quarter, but they've been one of the worst fourth quarter teams in basketball because they don't have, you know, they don't have their best shot maker. I mean, TJ is one of the best, play finishers in the NBA. And when you don't have that, I mean, you lose a lot of pop and just the, instead of passing to TJ Warren, with 12 seconds on the shot clock, you're passing to Justin Holiday, who's not great at attacking closeouts. Like it's either a spot up shot or bust pretty much. So it changes the calculus a lot.
Okay. I've got to vent some TJ Warren stuff. Like, I don't know what that guy has against the Hornets and Miles Bridges in particular, but I'm not kidding. Like last year, I'm telling you, like, That game where the Hornets had 42 free throws and the Pacers had 7. I don't know if you remember that one.
Oh, I remember that one, yes. And fans were not happy about that.
We closed with Cody Martin and Biombo, and because the comeback was so insane, Breger got no pushback, even though that clearly didn't work at all and nearly let the Pacers, you know, get the win. But I was happy with that win because, well, one, I didn't actually see the second half where the free throws really started to – you know, pile on the free throw disparity. But secondly, because TJ Warren was just seeing bullshit shots in Miles' face all game long. Like, and of course there's some sense to it. Like Miles actually started, I think he started okay on TJ Warren, but then TJ Warren started abusing like Marvin and Bacon and stuff and he got in rhythm. But at some point, like if you're hitting like, you know, spins into floaters that are contested and you're hitting just like legit hand in your face, pull up jumpers, like that's just when Miles was playing, like that's still one of Miles's best defensive performances in my opinion. And TJ gave him 35, and then he backed it up the next game by giving him 30 again. So, you know, fuck you, TJ Warren, for that, man. Like,
I mean, hey, he's from Carolina, so he always shows up for those games. Yeah, and it's not like he shows up for every game. He's like one of the most consistent players.
Yeah.
In the NBA, like,
and also we've talked about how Charlotte struggles massively with threes and fours that can actually move without the ball.
Yeah.
Which Warren has been historically a fairly good cutter, especially against us.
Yeah, he's he is one of the best cutters in the NBA. He's so good. Mm-hmm. Like, he's really good at like ghosting his cuts too, and just being really. Like it sounds stupid. Like if there's five guys on the court, you're going to notice if somebody's cutting, but like, he's really good at just moving the right way where guys lose him.
Don't worry, man. So like with some of the defenders who just play big minutes in the NBA, you know, I think like, I'm not kidding. Like there's probably like five top 20 players who regularly, like, you're just asleep off ball, you know, guys who just instinctively know how to move. can get a few free buckets that way. So,
and speaking of guys who are regularly asleep while fall, how is Caris LeVert's defense?
Yeah, dude, that is a great way to put it. His off ball has been a little bit better the last couple of games, but man, when he first came in, I mean, because he went from doing switch everything in Brooklyn to coming in and running all this crazy junk shit in Indiana. And he was just like the amount of times where he would just completely lose somebody a lot. His on ball, it's such a odd conundrum too, because like his on ball is like decent. Like he actually has had times where he's given guys fits on ball because he's just all limbs, like very much so able to get into the passing lanes a little bit. But yeah, the off ball is rough. He is not a good off ball defender. I really hope that he'll get better at that. That's one of the things I'm really interested to see too next year, because I mean, the Pacers were lauded as being the team where guys go to become good defenders. Like Bojan Bogdanović came and he went from being like one of the worst defenders in the league to being like passable. TJ Warren became a plus defender after being, and part of that is just, you know, not being on a, playing on the Suns makes you an automatic bad defender unless you're like Mikal Bridges. But I mean, that just hasn't really happened this year, and part of it's the year and all that. But also I'm just interested to see next year, like, is it just because the year's been weird, or is it because it's an entirely new staff than there has been for like the last, you know, decade? So it makes a definite impact. But yeah, his defense is not great. It's sometimes he can grade out to like neutral and occasionally above average, but for the most part, he's like probably like, I would call him like a C-minus defender. It's not like as catastrophic as it could be, because he's not normally guarding a great offensive player, but like, and he's able to make up for a lot of stuff with his length. Like if he was like 6'3" or 6'4", oh my God, that would be bad.
No, approximately Terry Rozier
shape. Yeah, I was just going to say that.
That's a great way to put it.
Okay, so I also wanted to say, like, yeah, so he was doing the switch everything in Brooklyn. And then before then, they were playing, as Joe constantly calls out, the most gimmicky deep drop, stubborn deep drop ever by Kenny Atkinson. And it worked by the numbers in the regular season, but basically he's played very least involving off-ball defensive rotations, just systems, probably that we've seen in a while in the NBA. So, yeah, Caris, like I'll defer to you guys in this defense. I always remember him just getting a few steals in the passing lanes, you know, and I just want that alone. I was like, okay, this guy's Jimmy Butler, but you know, obviously it's not quite. But though I did remember he used to guard the point of attack because, you know, he used to guard Kemba a few times, and I think he did okay. Like, so it will be interesting to see how that goes. I was personally really hoping to see, Brogdon, Caris, TJ, Sabonis, and how that really meshed on offense. Hearing TJ Warren's a good cutter, I didn't know that, is definitely big for that. But how has his fit been on offense? Because it seems that when I saw Caris coming to Indiana, the Sabonis-led team, I was envisioning him getting so many more of his looks off ball, because he's really good. He's got a really good first step almost. Like he's a really weird player. So good at just like getting low, and like his movements are so quick on that first step. But then like it seems like he's like wearing like chains. He's like someone shackling him as he's building off that advantage. And it might be just strategic, like he just, that's just like the way he likes to play. But it seems like that's the thing he does. And then, but I just imagine that going so well with Sabonis in that dribble handoff game. You know, he's good at that like jab, and then like juke back and cut. I've seen him do that a few times. And with his athletic traits, it seems like that's something he'd do well. But since that hasn't quite come to fruition, would you say that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard because he's coming off of, he's coming off of having cancer, and he still looks at times like he doesn't
That affects your basketball game?
It does have an impact. Who would have thought? So it's been like trying to evaluate him has been a little tough, because I want to be fair in that way. I think recently, though, like the last probably 10 or 15 games, like he's had a solid April. He's not shooting well from three. He's been pretty hit or miss from there. But in terms of like getting inside and finishing, he's been solid. When the biggest thing for him is just not making everything a pull up, because he's like one of those guys who it's frustrating to watch because you know he can get to the rim and he's capable of getting to the rim, but he just pulls up for shots from 10 to 12 feet a lot. And it kind of is a half measure for the offense and for him because he's good at the rim. Like, he's solid enough where he should be, you know, just get to the rim and see what happens. And he's not like quite good enough at the pull-up shots that he takes to take them as often as he does. And not to like try and like, you know, try and downgrade him and say that he can't do this or that or whatever, but it's just like, it's true. Like, TJ Warren is an elite mid-range shooter. Yes. Caris LeVert is like a good mid-range shooter. Like, he can shoot like 40 to 44% from mid-range, but it's not like, you know, it's not quite there. So the games can be really up and down for him from there. But like, I mean, he's had so, like, his best performances are coming when he gets all the way downhill. I think he's probably the best live dribble passer on the team already. Like, he's really great coming off double drags, finding the roller, finding the popper with wraparound passes. So he brings a lot to the team. And I agree. Like, I really would like to see him get off ball more, getting more looks off ball, I should say. And it's been interesting because a lot of the time when he's like, it's not even that it's his fault that he's not getting a lot of stuff off ball. Like, he's being put in the corner a lot in actions if he's not running it. Like, Malcolm is still technically the lead ball handler on the team. And a lot of the off ball looks are coming for him after, you know, so he'll run an action and then Caris gets the ball and it still feels my turn, your turn sometimes. So they're still working through that. But again, I would like to see a lot more Caris off ball because I think he's athletic enough to do it. He's got the length. It would be good for him and just getting him easier looks, but it hasn't, it hasn't really been the case a whole ton yet.
And that, I mean, that's totally fair for Bjorking is, so far, like, I see the reports of like these teams just having like two practices since like the All-Star break. And I just like, and just like, I think the Timberwolves didn't actually get to practice in the All-Star break. And I'm just like what the freak are you supposed to do as a coach?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I feel like Chris Finch is an offensive genius. He's like, that's everything. Every time someone can't like talks about Finch, they're like, okay, this guy draws up great sets and he's really creative with the way he thinks of offense. And we just haven't seen any of that. He's had to dumb down the offense so much. Like, he's lucky that Ant Cat Horns action is like cash money every time because otherwise, he wouldn't have a whole lot to go to. Without a proper training camp, it's so hard to get that sort just going. So I really hope, I hope next season with a proper training camp, we get to see a bit of that. What I thought would be the best two-man game or contender for the best two-man game in the league, Sabonis and LeVert, hopefully come to fruition.
Their two-man games look good too. Like, it's not perfect yet, but they've found some good synergy so far.
Okay, that's cool. Yeah, so you got anything to plug, Mark?
Yeah, for sure. First of all, thank you guys for having me on. This has been fun.
I'll just follow Mark on Twitter. Not what you say your handle, but he's been churning out some like good writing like recently.
I appreciate that, man. I'm trying my best. I'm finally about done with college in when 2 weeks. So now that I'm like pretty much done with all my finals work and stuff, I mean, I'm just gonna be writing and potting whenever I die. So that's where I'm headed. you can find me at Mschindler MBA on Twitter. Do most of my writing and potting over at premiumhoops.org. And you can find me on Indie Corners as well. Host the pot over there. And I don't write as Indie Corners as often, but I'll actually have something coming up there pretty soon as well.
All right. Awesome. It's been great having you on. Been really cool getting those paces insight. Mark, you've been great, man. So enjoy your day. Go cover the Hornets. Go cover the Pacers game. And thanks for coming on. And I will talk soon, I'm sure. So thank you, man.
Definitely.
Yeah.